This is the Daily Growth Discipleship Podcast. I'm Josh.
And I'm Chris. And today we're going to be talking to Chris Davis. Chris is a longtime friend and fellow CBC alum. Excited to talk to him. He's a youth pastor in Baltimore and a really great friend and someone I think we can learn a lot from in the way of living the discipleship lifestyle because this guy does it, you know. Everything from a social media post to the way that he lives with his wife and his kids and what he's striving to do each and every single day in ministry, he emanates the love of Christ. And it really comes through when you get to talk to him and when you get to know him. So I'm really excited to talk to Chris today and see what we can learn about the discipleship lifestyle.
Yeah, really, really great, thoughtful guy. So hope you guys enjoy this conversation. All right, guys, we are here today with Chris Davis. And Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for having me.
And Chris has been a longtime friend, like we mentioned earlier, went to CBC with him. I like to always give kind of fun facts about guests sometimes. At CBC, Chris used to have a big afro.
It was massive.
And I had a really long, nasty goatee, and so if people wanted to distinguish between which Chris on campus, they would have to point to their head or the goatee to to know which Chris they were talking about.
My wife's really quick to tell me that she's glad she met me after the afro. She's like, I don't think you would have got me with that thing. So,
yeah. <that's> worth. My wife says the same thing about that nasty goatee I had. So.
we all made foolish mistakes in our youth.
That's right. That's what college is for.
That's right.
But Chris, you are from Flint, Michigan, right?
Yes, sir. Born and raised.
Born and raised. A proud Michigander.
Yep.
And, you have an interesting story growing up in Flint. I know, Flint's been in the news here recently with some stuff going on. It's a pretty rough town. In fact, I just saw Springfield, where we live, made the top 10 worst cities in America to live. We were number 8, and I think Flint was number 2, right?
I was, yeah.
With just Detroit being number 1.
It's funny because I was born and raised in Flint, which was number 2. I saw Springfield shot up to number 8. And Baltimore's a pretty rough area where we are now, but Baltimore was number 9. So I joke around all the time when people say, Baltimore's like a vacation for me, you know. And so it's like, this is easy. So
that's right.
That's funny.
And I'm from Memphis, and that was number 4. So at least, I guess this is better than that, but I actually don't think so, but anyway, we digress.
Yeah.
So growing up in Flint, I know Flint was a rough area, and we had a bunch of other students, friends, that also grew up in Flint, Michigan. And so I know you kind of come from a little bit of a rough background. I was wondering if you could kind of talk about that a little bit and tell us what your journey has been like coming to faith in Christ, because you didn't grow up a Christian, right?
So growing up in Flint, we grew up in an all-black community. We were the only white family in our entire church. For most of my life, we were the only white family in our school until I changed schools later on in high school. But within black culture, for the most part, a lot of people, you just go to church because that's what you do on a Sunday. And so my mom would drag us to church all the time just because that's what you do. And so I went to church. I had some of those experiences early on and was but nothing ever really sank in. I didn't have faith. I would sleep on the back row of the church, and it was that kind of faith that I was brought up under. My mom was on fire, loved Jesus, but none of us kids ever really clicked or got it. And it took me much later in life until I was in high school before I found myself coming to Christ. And really the way it kind of played out for me is in a typical household for the area we grew up in. I didn't really have much of a relationship with my dad. He was in and out of jail, in and out of prison. He was absent because of drug addiction and various other things going on. Right now, I'm not 100% sure where he is. And so that's been kind of the relationship that we had with him, was in and out, in and out, in and out. And there's so many stories I could go into about that journey in and of itself. But because of the house that I grew up in, the arguing, my dad coming in and out, there were times we would come home from church and the house is completely empty because he pawned everything that we owned so he could go get high. And, just instances like that. What happened for me, though, just kind of growing up in that culture and in that atmosphere, you just become hard and your heart becomes hardened. And I think it's always ironic that Flint, you know, is called what it is, because the people of Flint, a lot of them have such a hardened heart. And we know that Flint is like a stone, you know, and it just kind of was fitting of that area. But so many people, you go through experiences that the experiences begin to shape who you become. And so for so long, I just felt like even at a young age, my heart was getting harder and harder and harder. I had this kid in high school named Nathan Murray. And this kid, he loved Jesus. He went to this church on the outskirts of Flint, and he bugged me every single week in high school. Like, would you go to church with me? Would you go to church? And I'm like, no, no, no. Constantly shutting him down. And then all of a sudden one day, myself and my brother Kevin, we went to this party on a weekend, had no business being there. Bottom line, we were on the wrong side of town, hanging out with the wrong people. And, you know, I ended up getting jumped pretty bad. There was about seven guys that surrounded me and him, and, you know, they gave it to us pretty good. And then I remember there was a guy that he stood up in the bed of his pickup truck, and then he took a shotgun and he pointed it in my face, and then he went to pull the trigger, and at the last second, the gun jammed. And at that moment, it just seemed like everything just froze, and I didn't really know what to do. And I think even they were surprised. And so I like hit the gun out of my face, and I just took off running into this nearby cornfield. And I remember I just got as far back in there as I could, and I just fell to the ground, and I'm just weeping, you know. And these guys they're in the truck driving through the field looking for me, and I'm just weeping. Like in that moment, I'm like, I know that was God. I know that God, you know, saved me in that moment. And so the following week, I know, here comes Nate Murray asking me, hey, you want to go to church? And this time I'm like, you know what, man, I think I do want to go this time. And but even still, when I started going to church with him, it wasn't an instantaneous thing. I was very skeptical. I will say the first week that we went, we were pretty late showing up to service, and the entrance was in the back. And so we come in the back door. Worship is already going. And it was the first time I had ever experienced kids my age actively engaged in worship. And I felt the presence of God just like I did in that cornfield. I felt it in that sanctuary when I walked in and into that youth room. And in that moment, I'm like, OK, there's something here. And I wasn't fully ready to commit at that point. It was at least another 3 months before I made that decision to follow Jesus. But for me, it took having those experiences to actually feel the presence of God in order to say, okay, there's something here. Like, this thing is real. And, you know, that's really kind of what got me into the church in general and kind of really beginning to grow in my faith.
Yeah. Wow, man. What an incredible story. That's crazy. Not a lot of people, you know, experience something that powerful. What was a big turning point for you, though? You said your heart had become hard, and obviously it took about that 3 or 4 month period to really kind of soften you up, and you recognized that something was going on. So what kind of led you to that? And maybe while you're thinking about it, you know, because I have – my story is kind of similar in that I walked away from the Lord. When I came back, I had an experience where I got introduced to a really strong Pentecostal, Southern Pentecostal church. And I remember sitting in a prayer meeting and feeling, having that same experience of like, the presence of God is here.
Right.
Like, this is incredible. Because like you were saying, kids my age were praying incredibly. And it wasn't just kind of like the, you know, they stand in a circle and kind of say like a mediocre prayer, man. They were pursuing hard after God. And, but same thing. I wasn't ready to commit yet either. And so what was it that kind of led you to softening that heart up and saying, you know what, this really is something that I want to throw my lot in with and follow Christ?
You know what, man, it for me, it was just kind of a continual, it was almost like a continual chiseling. Like each week that I went back, it was like a little piece of that stone was chipped away and chipped away and chipped away. And it was a long process. But the more that I saw that this thing was real, the students meant it. The youth pastor was a super genuine guy. As somebody that didn't have a father figure growing up, he kind of took me under his wing. He allowed me to do kind of an unofficial internship with him while I was still in high school. And even after I started going to the youth group, I messed up, made a lot of mistakes. And he really was the first person to take me under his side and say, hey, that's okay. Like, I'm going to help you work through these things. And so my relationship with him definitely helped kind of push through to realize the relational aspect of the faith rather than like the do's and don'ts that I witnessed in the church growing up. Mm-hmm. And so for me, like I said, it was each week. My youth pastor, he used to close every single sermon the same way. He was one of those guys that he would say, if you were to walk out of church right now today and you get hit by a bus, do you know where you're going, heaven or hell? And so, you know, it was one of those things where I knew he was going to end the sermon like that each week. And each week I could just kind of feel this little tug, like, do you know, like, do you really know? And finally, about 3 months in, you know, I knew he was going to end the sermon that way. And before he even got the question out, I'm like jumping over rows of chairs, like run up to the front. I'm like, I want to go to heaven. And like, you know, I want this thing. And so it's in that moment, like my heart just, it literally felt like my heart just broke. And, you know, it's just a crazy softening. I even shared this story with our students last night in our youth group. You know, I'm really pressing our students right now for the idea of, you can't follow Jesus and stay the same. It's just impossible. Like, if you're actually pursuing and following Jesus, pursuing what it means to be Christ-like, things in your life will change. Before church, my mom and I would argue all the time. I would steal money from her. A terrible relationship, primarily from my end. Like, I did not make life easy on her. And, you know, my room was a mess. I never did anything around the house. The night I got saved, the first thing I did when I got home was clean my room.
Wow.
And then I went out and I took the trash out and I could see my mom like peeking around the corner. She's like, whose kid is this? And I'm like, and so I could see her like looking and, but I'm like, and I didn't even think about it at the time, but it literally like was in that moment that I responded to that pulling that I felt like my character began to shift and began to change like right away. And so really, like I said, the turning point, like you asked to that point, it was just a gradual chipping away of that hardness. And then once I actually stepped out and responded to that, it's like the dam just broke open and I just felt, you know, the presence of God in a way like never before. Mm-hmm. Just this piece of, you know, it's okay. You know, the house I grew up in, part of what kept me from wanting to respond, especially during the 3 month window of time, was, if God is so good, why does my house look like this? Why are my parents arguing all the time? Why is my dad a drug addict? Why are all these things taking place? And those were the questions that I was wrestling with that kept me from responding for those 3 months. And in that moment, though, none of that mattered. You know, the presence of God was so much more real than those circumstances that, you know, I'm like, I got to give myself over to this. And I'm so glad that I did. But that was definitely the turning point. Was it was just a gentle, constant pursuit. And, you know, once I responded, it all just went full blast from there.
Yeah.
There's a really great observation there. What does what did your life look like and your perspective of God look like after you kind of came down off that high, though? Because
this is an interesting part of the journey. You know, I went to CBC with you guys, and I'm not sure how much you guys know fully of my CBC story even. So all this takes place roughly about my junior year of high school. Throughout the process of junior year and senior year, my youth pastor was the first one to say, hey, I feel like you have a calling on your life to go into ministry. He took me down to CBC to check the school out. Right away, I felt like that's where I was supposed to be. So I went all in and jumped in. And right off the bat, though, at CBC, I felt like a square peg in a round hole. And I'm probably not the only one that felt that way. But I'm like looking around and I'm like, you know what? I'm not a pastor's kid. I'm not a missionary's kid. I just got saved not that long ago. And, you know, that kind of created some insecurity in myself. But I put my best foot forward and I kept pursuing. I felt like I was pursuing Jesus the best that I knew how. But I was still limited in my knowledge of how to do that. And, really kind of what ended up happening for me was, you know, there's some stuff behind the scenes. I started getting in trouble here and there and just doing some dumb stuff on the side that I had no business doing. And it's kind of one of those Paul experiences. Like, I'm not doing the things that I want to do and I'm doing the things I don't want to do. And that wrestling with that tension. And and really, ultimately, all that caught up with me. And I ended up getting suspended from CBC. And long story short, I'll jump back to it. But for the sake of anybody listening, don't judge me. I got back in. But anyway, so I get suspended from CBC. And at this point, I'm looking at the full big picture of things. And I'm like, look, why did this happen? I'm blaming everybody except for myself. And, you know, I was ready to just walk away from the faith, to walk away from ministry, to walk away from all of it. Like, look, this clearly isn't for me. But what happened next is God took me on this incredible journey where he just started showing me some stuff in my life that, yes, I had this experience early on, But there were still some deeply rooted issues that I had to let go of, that I had to get rid of and to give to him. And so in the early years of my CBC experience, I felt like I'm pursuing God, but kind of with this ball and chain around my ankles, that I'm reaching out, but I can only reach so far because there's all this baggage that I'm just holding on to. And so during the period of my suspension, I just felt like God was just telling me, like, hey, all this stuff you've been carrying, you've got to give that to me. And a lot of it stemmed from my dad or my relationship with him or the lack thereof during this window of time he was in prison in Michigan. And I felt like God told me, like, hey, you need to go visit him and tell him that you forgive him for everything. And I'm like, man, no way. You know, there's no way I'm doing that. I go home for Thanksgiving and I'm like, okay, let's do this. I get in the car, get about halfway there, and then I turn around. I'm like, you know what? I'm not doing it. Like, he doesn't deserve to be forgiven. I'm not forgiving this guy for anything. So then I go back to Missouri. I'm beating myself up the entire break in between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And just kind of like, man, you know what you have to do? Like, why can't you do it? Like, it was so hard for me to just take that final step. Christmas comes. I finally go see him. And then in that moment, I don't even remember the full conversation. It wasn't very long. But I just told him, look, I'm not doing this for you. I'm doing this for me because I want to follow who God has called me to be and what he's trying to do in my life. I forgive you for everything that has happened up to this point. And I just left it all there. And the second I walked out of that prison, I literally felt like somebody just lifted a weight vest off of me. And I had this experience. It was so freeing in that moment. And it was cool to see, though, because immediately on the heels of that, I go back to Springfield. Right after that, I met Victoria, who's now my wife. Right after that, I got this job that I had no business getting. I was not qualified for yet, working with homeless youth in Springfield, an absolutely awesome job. Got this great place to live, and just so much immediately followed my obedience to what I felt like I was supposed to do in that moment. And really from that point on, you know, it's been like God's just been taking me through this thing, kind of like, all right, now let's catch up on everything we missed and let's go here. And but that really was kind of it for me. Is like, you have that early experience, and it took me going through that process to learn. And now looking back, I can understand why Paul tells Timothy, hey, you know, if you're going into ministry, like, it shouldn't be somebody that's young in their faith. And that was me in that moment, to where I was young in my faith and wanting to pursue this. But there was so much other stuff that I had to understand it before I could actually finally pursue this. And I'm so glad that I had that experience early on, as opposed to later on when I jump into ministry and my life's a train wreck because I got all this baggage that I refuse to let go of. And, you know, but God's been really good throughout that process. And but still then, to get into ministry, I'm sorry, I'm rambling a little bit here. Still then, though, after that experience, my wife and I, we finished CBC. We're living in Springfield. We get married, had our first kid. And I just told myself, look, just get a job, be a good dad, be a good husband, go to church. I convinced myself on the heels of that CBC experience that that was enough for me, because I still had some scarring from what happened with getting suspended from CBC, the way that process played out, some things that were said during that period of time. But for me, I was really blessed. And I think, Chris, you saw this a while back. From day one, when my youth pastor said, hey, I feel like you're called to be in ministry, God has given me people in every chapter of my life that have confirmed that. And, you know, the best thing that I have been able to do is to write those experiences down. And what ended up happening is I was blessed with this friend named John DeForest. He went to Evangel. And all along the way, while I'm in Springfield, he's kind of kicking me in the pants. He's like, hey, man, you know what you're supposed to be doing. You know you're supposed to be in ministry. But I had some insecurity and kind of some shame from my experience at CBC that held me back. And we go to this men's retreat. The guy that was preaching prays for me after service, calls everything out by name that I was kind of struggling with. And, you know, I just let it all there that night. That weekend, I get home and I tell my wife, hey, I feel like this is it. Like, everything's behind me. I feel like God is preparing us to go into ministry. We need to start preparing ourselves accordingly. Exactly 1 year later to the day, we accepted the position that we're at now. Wow. So it's been a pretty crazy process, you know. And it's certainly, I think it's not conventional. You know, there's many ups and downs and mountains and valleys in there. But through it all, every season has been a learning curve that I feel like has prepared me for where we are now and moving forward, whatever God has for us. I know that every season prior to this has played a part in the successes that we're experiencing now with the youth group that we have.
You know, you bring up a really good point about the seasons of life and the learning curve, and I want to come back around and talk about that process in particular. But before we do, I want to back up a little bit and hit on something you mentioned. If it's okay, if you want,
yeah,
you can say pass. We can pass it. And talk about, you know, you said when you were able to forgive your dad and you walked out of that jail and, you know, you felt like that burden had been lifted. Did that change or shift the way that you viewed God as a father? Because I know a lot of people who, you know, have either dealt with father issues or, you know, absentee father, or even just somebody who has a father, you know, that's in their life. It ends up impressing upon them the way they view God. And so I want to you to maybe talk about how that changed you.
Yeah, absolutely, man. So for me, I think that was the primary piece of my relationship with God that was missing on the upfront part. Like, I had the experiences, I started to get some of the knowledge, but that part was missing. And I think that's what led me to the point I was at. And going through that experience, because when I was at CBC, I'm reading all these verses, you know, we're adopted in as sons and daughters, but like, what does that really mean? Mm-hmm. You know, and it was hard for me to understand what that meant to just to be a son, just to be able to rest in the fact of, hey, you don't have to do everything yourself. Because what happens for a lot of people that have either absentee fathers or, you know, a poor example of a father is you begin to take on this mindset of you have to do everything yourself. If you want something, you do it yourself. You know, and it's so prevalent in our society nowadays that we make independence this thing to be, you know, desired. But it's like, hey, when you know what it means to be a son or a daughter of God, then there's a certain confidence that comes from it. Not an arrogance, but a confidence of knowing like, hey, like, do you know who my dad is? Like, he owns a cattle on a thousand hills. Like, you know, this need that I have, like what I'm seeking in this season, the comfort that I'm looking for, like he's got it. And so in that moment, it completely opened up this whole other realm of my relationship with God. And, you know, I know this might sound crazy to some people, I don't have a lot of experiences like this, so I share this kind of hesitantly. I know some people may think I'm weird or whatever, but there's one night in particular on the heels of this experience that I was just in my dorm room when I'd gotten back to CBC. I was in my dorm room, and you know, I'm just praying. In that moment, I really just felt this longing. I was like, man, you know what? I would just love just to be like embraced right now, like to be hugged right now. And I'm laying on my bed, and then I just felt like God just told me, he said, hey, you know, just stretch your arms out. And so I'm laying on my dorm room bed, just crying, like wanting to be rest. And I just put my arms out, and I felt like this peaceful embrace that I've never had an experience like that since that time. But in that moment, it was almost like God confirmed in that moment, like, hey, I am here. Like, this father that you're seeking, like, I am him. Like, I am. And in that moment, the peace was so unreal that just blew the lid off that missing aspect of my relationship with God. And even still now, working through how to be a husband, how to be a dad, when you didn't have that example, you know, that's so much easier now because of that element of my walk with God being opened up and just being able to be confident in who he is, what he's done for me. You know, and it just takes a burden off of me. Like, I don't have to perform and do as much because, you know, God's got my back, you know. And if I'm constantly essentially passing my burdens to him, life gets a whole lot easier. But when we are caught in this independent mindset of I'm a strong, independent person, I don't need anybody, I don't need community, I can do it on my own, you're going to get bogged down eventually. That's just the way that it is. And I felt like from that moment on, from that experience, whatever burdens or baggage come along, I'm really quick to say, hey, all right, here you go, God. Here you go. Like, loading them up because, you know, that's what he's there for. And he wants that. He wants us to share those burdens with him. But it took me getting to that point and having that experience in order to fully realize that, like, hey, you don't have to carry all this stuff, you know. And that was such a freeing moment in my relationship with God where my pursuit of him, it just took off from there. Like, this whole other piece that I had no idea really existed.
Wow. That's cool. That is really cool. You know, because that's one of the things I admire about you the most is your what I've seen your ability to learn and kind of change and adapt over time and handle that growth curve. So I was going to ask a question about that, but you kind of already answered it of like, how did you get to where you seem to learn or you tackle these new changes in these learning environments with open arms. You know, you embrace them. I remember when you did announce in one of our Facebook groups that you'd got this position as youth pastor in Baltimore, man. And well, even still now you do it, but definitely like within the first few months, you were always asking questions. Hey, how do you guys do this? Or what's your advice for that? And a lot of people are really afraid to reach out and ask for help. And you do that so well. Can you tell us maybe how you overcame that that fear? I deal with that fear all the time. You know, well, maybe they're gonna, you know, they're gonna think that I'm not like, I think I have to live up to a standard.
Yeah, I mean, that's an expectation for the Christian life. I mean, Chris, you and I've talked about it before. That's why people don't pray, like to pray in public. Mm-hmm. They don't know how, and they don't feel like they can just ask somebody, how do I pray in front of other people? Because there's kind of this unwritten rule that good Christians do that, so you should just be expected to do it. Yeah. So you just kind of hope your name's never called and you never have to pray in front of other people, so they don't know that you don't know how.
And so that's
a really, really valuable thing to learn as a Christian, is just how to ask for help.
You know what? And I think that in general, kind of tying together with another topic that I'm pretty passionate about. From the day I got to CBC's campus, my very first day, I don't know if you guys remember Brother Bradley.
Mm-hmm. Bradley.
Oh, yeah.
So freshman orientation, I remember Ron Bradley, he stands up at the front of the chapel and he's talking and he says something along the lines of, he said, hey, I'm here. If any of you guys need anything, I'm here for you. You know, and you know where to find me. He said something along those lines. Immediately after that chapel service, we had lunch, and I remember he grabs a tray, gets his food, and he goes and sits off to the side. And so I go grab a tray, get my food, and I go join him in his booth. And he just kind of gives me this weird look. I said, you said you were here. Like, I'm here. Like, let's go. And so he just kind of looked at me and, like, let out this laugh. And he was like, you know what? He said, that's awesome, man. And from that day forward, even still now, we have such a great relationship. He's been a great mentor in my life. But in each season, I've sought out different people that, you know, I feel like God has kind of put my life for a reason in those seasons. And in that moment, in seeing how faithful God has been in providing those people to help give me the answers, because I think the best thing that you can know is what you don't know. I'm new to ministry. There's a lot that I don't know, but I know that there are a lot of people out there that have those answers, that have the experience. And so going back to the Brother Bradley thing, I think what happens a lot of time with our generation, you know, millennials, Gen X's, even Generation Z coming up, is I think most of us, by and large, we want to be poured into, but we expect somebody else to come along and grab us and say, hey, let's do this thing. Like, no, if you want to be poured into, you have to be proactive in seeking people out. Like, you have to go find that. Like, mentors aren't just walking around the street, like, looking for kids to snatch up. Like, it doesn't work that way. You know, so, like, it's not like a mentor van driving around town, like, hop in. You know, it doesn't work like that. You've got to pursue that yourself. And that's something that I learned really early on. And I think that thing with Brother Bradley was kind of a divine thing, because I don't even know why I did that. It was just so weird. But from that point on, seeing how he responded to that, it helped me to be more willing to ask in each season. So even still now, transitioning into ministry, I've been really blessed with some awesome friends that have a lot of ministry experience from our time at CBC, from various places that I've been because of Floodgate Tour. I've been able to meet people all over the country. And so I know that there are a lot of people that know a lot more than I do. And so I have no problem reaching out to them, say, hey, what do you do? And, you know, Mark Batterson, I was reading in one of his books today, he said a book is usually about 2 years of somebody's life experience. And so I kind of view that almost in the same sense of like, hey, let me ask you this because you have the experience. And if you can tell me in about 10 minutes what you've learned in about 2 years, sign me up for that. Like, I'll take that all day long. And so, you know, I think that's it for me, is like, hey, people look at me, I turned 30 this year. And, you know, I'm like, hey, I'm a youth pastor and I'm turning 30. Like, they assume like, oh, you must have like 8 or 9 years of experience. I'm like, no, this is actually 1 year in here, you know, and, you know, so I'm like, I got a lot of catching up to do. There's a lot of people that have been at this for a long time, and I've got no qualms about reaching out to people, because I know that, hey, some people have been doing this for a long time and they've learned lessons the hard way. So if I can just have a conversation with you online or across the coffee table and learn what it took you years to process through, you know, I'll take that any day of the week.
Yeah, man, that's great. Because I think that is such an undervalued skill, and really I think it's a spiritual discipline that we don't practice enough in the church, is that willingness to ask and to learn from others' experiences. I feel like too much in the church we feel like it's a journey we have to go it alone. And you know, I definitely relate to, you know, your desire. It would be really nice if somebody just walk into your office and be like, hey, I'm going to mentor you today. And you'd be like, great, let's go.
Right.
Unfortunately, we have to be a little bit more proactive. But I also think that's a great lesson to people like us, you know, that you were talking about millennials and Gen Xers and Gen Zs that do want to be poured in, to kind of be the people that we also wanted to pour into us. And so it's about looking for other people that we can pour into as well. You know, we all need to be being poured into by somebody else, and then finding somebody else to pour into as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's
absolutely
always somebody who's not as far along as you are, and somebody who's farther along than you are.
That's right.
And so it's always helpful to pass that along and continue to learn as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think from my experience so far, in my vast experience of 1 year in ministry, I feel like that whole process is tougher when you're in ministry, because people assume, hey, this guy's got it all together. Mm-hmm. He doesn't. But even here in this position here in Baltimore, I was really intentional about I waited a while, kind of, you know, observed some things and prayed about it. And I felt like there was a particular individual that I wanted to, hey, you know, this guy's got some things that I don't have spiritually. I believe that he has some depth and some roots that I don't have yet. And so I just met him one day and talked with him and just kind of shared with him my heart and said, hey, man, I'd like to meet with you biweekly if that's okay with you. And I just want to pick your brain. And, you know, and he was excited. He was like, man, I've been looking for people to like pour into. He's like, he's an older guy. And I think he's at the point where he's like, look, I feel like I've learned these things and I want to pass these lessons on. He was like, and he kind of shared with me, he was like, it just seems like your generation is not listening, or they're not wanting that knowledge. And I'm like, like I said, for us, we have to go out and seek that. People are wanting to share that, especially within the church. That's one thing that I've noticed, is we've got a great group of elders in our church here. They're wanting to share that. And so now I'm trying to help bridge the gap between them and our youth group. Like, how do we connect them? How do we get them? And you've got to want it. If you want it, go get it. You know, as far as those relationships go, it's not going to happen by accident. You know, and no growth happens by accident. It happens by intentional pursuit.
That's excellent. Well said. So what are you doing then now as a youth pastor to pour into others? How do you go about, do you look at it a little bit more strategically? I mean, obviously you have a responsibility to any kid that walks in your youth group, and so you take that responsibility seriously, I'm sure. But with everything, you know, maybe you have your 12 that you really pour into particularly, or maybe you're the 3. And so how do you go about identifying those relationships and pouring into them?
Yeah. So by and large, the youth group dynamics we have here are pretty interesting. When we first got here about a year ago, we were averaging about 55 kids. Now within the last couple months, we've been averaging between 90 and 100. We've had some pretty solid growth there. The majority of our youth group now, because of the growth that we've had, though, is unchurched kids that have no concept of church, no relationship with God, none of this, like starting from square one. So we have this portion of maybe 20 to 25 church kids that have some working knowledge of religion. Mm-hmm. And then the vast majority are like square one. So even at the beginning of the year, we started like all the way at the basics. So what has been difficult is finding that balance of pouring into those that are a little more advanced, but still remaining kind of down here enough for the kids that have no experience to still be able to grab something and to catch on to what we're trying to do. So the biggest thing for me is, and I share this with our youth leaders, we've got a really solid team of youth leaders here. And I'm like, I can't intentionally pastor 90 kids. It just doesn't work that way. That's not how pastoring works. And so I'm like, I kind of view our youth leaders, and I want them to see themselves essentially as an extension of me. Like, hey, you know, if all of you guys, we have a team of about 15 youth leaders. I'm like, if all of you are connecting with a few kids, then all of them are going to be touched and all of them are going to reach. So I essentially see myself as primarily pastoring the leaders and then helping them to pastor the kids. Now, with that, there are definitely some kids in our youth group that you can just see them almost like foaming at the mouth for this thing. Like, I want all that God has for me, you know? And so, you know, those kids are, like I was saying earlier, they're proactive. Like, they'll come to me like, what can I do to grow? What can I do to grow? Like, I had a kid after service last night literally come up to me and ask that question. She's like, hey, like, I want more. Like, what can I do? What else can I do in those situations? You know, I do as much as I can to help those kids. You know, we'll do some reading plans together, and, you know, I'll text a few kids. I'll try to get a couple things like that going as far as, like, intentional growth. And, you know, the Bible app is so great with helping with that. You can do a plan with a few people, leave your comments on there, and kind of that provides accountability, helps them get in the habit of reading, getting their thoughts on that, and some little things like that. So any kid that's to that point, you know, we're helping with that. But primarily I see my job as developing our leaders the best that I can and pastoring them the best that I can, because the better and the healthier they are, the better our group as a whole will be. And I think that's what's difficult a lot of times in some churches, is that if we see the pastor as the primary influencer, then you're really limiting what your church is going to be capable of doing, because you can't have a personal connection with everybody in your church, even in smaller church settings. It's impossible. You're one person, you have limited resources and limited time. And so the more that we empower other people that are working alongside of us to be influencers and to make these connections and to teach them how to do that, they were going to build this sustainable, recyclable process that's going to continue to produce disciples.
That's good. I want to ask a question that we may or may not cut out. We'll see. when you're pouring into somebody who's starting at square one, what are some of the basic things that you want to help them understand, and some areas that you would say, let's work on growing here first?
Mm-hmm. I would say probably the primary thing we did here, and this was overall with some individuals, but with our group as a whole, the biggest thing that we started with and that we really wanted to drive home is value, that you have value. Your life has value. We live in a society where so many of these kids nowadays deal with depression and anxiety, and they feel left out and worthless, and establishing in them that they have value and then helping them make the connection of, hey, your value was set the day that God breathed life into your soul, and it was reaffirmed the day that Christ paid that price for your soul. Your value is already set. Your circumstances, the home you grow up in, the decisions that you made, your value does not change. How you may see that may change. And so really the primary goal off the bat is, like, if we can just get them to open their eyes to how valuable they are to God, how valuable they are because of the price that Christ paid for them, then that's going to help them to say, okay, why did Jesus pay this price for me? You know, why am I so valuable? And so what we have been hammering home for the last 3 months with our kid is that you have a place and a purpose in the body of Christ. And we've been just driving that idea home. And it's really starting to gain some traction. Now we can see some kids, their entire countenance is changing because they see and can sense that value now. And so from there, you know, you can go a lot deeper, but it takes, with the generation we have nowadays, I think because of the depression, the anxiety, that you've got to establish that worth with so many of our students, because it's high school was tough when I was in it, and in junior high as well. But I mean, it seems like a whole nother ball game now. I go to schools for, you know, Bible studies and things like that, or even basketball games. And I'm like, this is crazy. You know, part of it could be the area that we're in, but in general, I'm like, this is nuts, you know? So helping kids to know their value, though, is going to help them to see themselves differently. And then it's also going to open up their mind to some questions about, why are you that valuable? Now, what do you do with this value?
Mm-hmm. That's awesome, man. Well, hey, we're coming up on the end of the recording, so I've got a couple questions that I want to ask. But one bonus question that I want to sneak in here. You've also had a pretty incredible journey with physical fitness over the years. And so I wanted to ask you real quick about how you thought about physical health, physical fitness fitting into your discipleship lifestyle and what you do as a Christian.
Yeah. So really for me, you know, you guys remember back when I had the Afro, I was a stick figure, man. I couldn't get to save my life. And it really took me during that suspension period. I had so much angst and energy built up and just not really knowing what to do with it all, and just really was sorting through a lot of stuff at that point in time, a lot of heavy things. And I just started going to the gym one day at OTC there in Springfield, and it just kind of stuck. I went a couple times and I was like, you know what? That feels pretty good. And then I just kind of kept going, and it was a positive way for me to get out a lot of the angst and energy that I had. And so then it began to become a habit. And now for me, what I realize is sometimes, you know, if my devotional life gets off, if my reading life gets off, or if my prayer life gets off, some things like that. For me, what I've found is if I am disciplined in my fitness life, because usually I'll get up and I'll work out first thing in the morning. Not as much lately with the newborn, but I'm getting back on track. But if I get up and I work out first thing in the morning, it helps me be disciplined throughout the rest of my day, because I feel like I've already kind of put myself in a position of it wakes me up. It gets my soul ready. Like, I'll usually listen to a podcast while I'm working out. It just puts me in that frame of mind that if I can be disciplined in this area, it helps me be disciplined in everything else. And so when we first got here, the first few weeks, I wasn't able to work out at all just because there was so much transition. And I really felt the effects of that. And I told my wife, I said, look, I really feel like I have to make it a priority to get to bed a little bit earlier so I can get up earlier and get back into this habit. And once I did, I noticed a difference right away. And so, you know, for me, I view my body and I view my life as a gift from God. And just like any other gift from God, it is to be stewarded. And so I feel like as I do my best to steward that God kind of gives me some grace in some other areas. You know, I know that may not apply to everybody. Not everybody can get up and work out in the morning, but I do believe that physical fitness is a huge part of, you know, what we're supposed to do. And that could look like 100 different things. There's so many different things out there for us nowadays, but I believe a part of that is if you make it a mindset to say, okay, God, this life that you've given me, we know according to scripture that our life is but a mist. It's gone in a moment. And so the very fact that we have this life right now is a gift. If we approach God and say, hey, I want to steward this thing the best that I can. I want to live as long as possible so I can make a greater impact for your name. And if we approach him in that sense, I think that that's going to help you. It just kind of revives your soul in a way like very few other things do. At least that's the case for me. And, you know, I think that it will probably always be a big part of what I do. Some of the greatest discipleship moments that I've had have been with people at the gym. You know, I go to the gym at a certain time. I'll meet somebody. I'll get to know them over an extended period of time. They find out a little bit about me. We start talking about Jesus and build this relationship. And it each time, each gym that I've gone to, each season that I've been into, there's a couple relationships that I know that I wouldn't have made any other way. And so it's this awesome thing that I feel like it helped me get through that really rocky season of being suspended at CBC and just helped me get that nervous energy out. And I also feel like today, nowadays, with a lot of the mental health issues that are so prevalent in society, fitness is a great release to get just some of that out and to get some positive energy inside of yourself, to start feeling good about yourself. And that makes a tremendous difference. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I think it's a very underrated aspect of our Christian lives, is that we are created physical beings and we're meant to move, we're meant to exercise. And like you said, sometimes, and not just sometimes, I think most of the time for people, being disciplined in that one area, that physical fitness area, you know, pays many dividends for every other aspect of your life. And so, you know, if you're wanting to be more disciplined in prayer and Bible reading and journaling and meditation, oftentimes you need to just start by going to the gym.
And, and the biggest thing for me too, in that season of being suspended from CBC, it really helped me to make the correlation of pain equaled growth. You know, in working out, I'm essentially literally tearing muscle fibers. And then the next week that I come back, they've healed and they're stronger. And so that kind of helped me to make that connection in my spiritual life, that you can go through some things and it may hurt and you're going to go through some seasons just because of the nature of the world that we live in, where some things are just terrible and it's hard and it's rough on you. But those seasons usually produce growth if you allow them to. And so kind of experiencing that psychological process of, hey, just because something hurts doesn't mean that it's bad. Just because something hurts doesn't mean it's to be avoided. You know, we're to count it all joy, you know, when we go through trials of many kinds. And so it helped me to really fully understand what that means, that just because something's difficult or it's painful doesn't mean that it's to be shied away from. It could be an opportunity of growth. And so making that correlation from working out translated into my spiritual life of working through some of that difficulty in that season that I was in.
Mm-hmm. That's huge. We are so quick to dismiss pain. Like, I've been kind of checked by the Holy Spirit sometimes during like prayer times, and you listen to some people's prayer requests, and I'm not judging their prayer requests, but sometimes I just felt God saying, sometimes we really ask to get out of things really quickly before we've taken the opportunity to say, God, how can I learn more about you in this situation? How can I learn more about myself in this situation?
Absolutely.
And we're so quick to dismiss pain of any kind just because it hurts.
Yeah. And the way I see it too is, and I always remember this, and it stuck out to me one day, and it's always kind of in the back of my mind. Jesus tells that story of the two houses. One was built on sand, one was built on rock. And, you know, of course, the house that was built on sand, it says the floods came, the rains came down, the winds beat against the house was washed away. The second house, it said the floods rose, rain came down, the winds blew, but the house stood. Now, and I thought about it. I'm like, you know, Jesus could have very easily been like, this house that was built on this foundation, it was 75 and sunny every day, it had no problems. But in both exact situations, the same floods came, the same rains came, and the same winds blew. And so we get this perception of following Jesus should be easy. No, following Jesus means that when the storms come, you're going to be able to stand through them. It doesn't mean that it's going to take the storms away. And so being able to make that correlation, like you're saying, of, you know, don't avoid the pain. Usually growth comes through the pain.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, if somebody came to you tomorrow, and they probably do, and they might actually, since you're a youth pastor and you've already kind of given an example of this, and they said, you know, Chris, I want to become a better disciple in every aspect of my life. What are the three most important pieces of advice or action items you would give them?
You know what? It's funny you ask that because we're kind of going through we're just wrapping up a series we did with our students right now. We call it H3, talking about heads, habits, and hearts, and how they're all kind of intertwined and how they all work together. And that's kind of one of the things that I presented to our students. I at the beginning of each message, asked the kids, hey, how many of you in here would consider yourself to be a Christian? Almost all of them unanimously raised their hands. And I'm like, okay, how do you know? How do the people around you know? Do your habits reflect a heart that's following God? And, you know, we start looking at some of those things. And so it really is, as cliche as it sounds, it gets back to the basics of reading, of praying. And for me, I think the third would be journaling, because writing down, you know, if you want to hear from God, write down what he tells you, because he could tell you something right now for today, or he could tell you something that's going to apply later on, and it could take you looking back on that journal, like I recently had that experience, to have those words come back to life for you. But it's so easy to say, yeah, okay, like I know we should do that. Duh, everybody should read. Everybody should pray. Okay, but then why don't you do it? Like, it's easy to say, yeah, I know we need to do these things, but you know, if it were that easy, then we wouldn't need to keep reminding you to do that. And there was a quote, I don't remember if it was Mark Batterson or John Acuff. I read a little of both of them today. But the quote said, when you open the Bible, God's opening his mouth. And that's literally how that is. You know, you want to hear from God, open the Bible. It's that simple. And so we've really been just trying to coach our kids on the basics of that and working through some of the uncomfortability with that. And how do you read the Bible? How do you pick a place to start? How do you start praying? And working through some of that. Because what happens is a lot of times we see the person that has the really advanced faith and we're like, yeah, I want to get there, but how do I get there is the question. And so really helping our kids to know that, you know, you just start with today, and tomorrow you build on what you did today and it keeps moving forward. And at the beginning of this year, we had each kid write a letter to themselves about where they are in their spiritual walk. And our goal is to give them that letter back at the end of the year to do an honest self-evaluation and say, hey, the goal at the end of this year is not perfection, but the goal is that you look back and can see the growth that you've had throughout this year because you've put in place the habits to build a long-lasting faith. And so, like I said, it gets back to those basic elements of reading, praying, and journaling. You know, it sounds so simple, but if it were really that simple, more people would be doing it.
Mm-hmm. And what has been one of the most valuable things that you've learned throughout your Christian life? We find that most Christians have kind of had like one of those encounters where, and you've kind of alluded to this a little bit, I think, already in your testimony, but it's like, once you learned that, once you came to that realization or understanding, everything changed for you. You couldn't go back to living the same, maybe mediocre Christian life that you had before. Do you have any big ideas on that?
Yeah, that's a big question. You know, for me, I would say there was an experience where I was working at the homeless center in Springfield, and we worked with homeless youth. Our job was to essentially help them become independent, be able to live on their own and things like that. And I worked third shift overnights. And there was this kid that came in one night, late at night, was talking to me. And I don't even know if I was supposed to be able to talk about my faith, but I started talking about my faith with this kid. And then and he told me as I'm talking to him, he was like, man, he was like, you know, when you started talking about that, he was like, your eyes lit up. He was like, you like completely came alive. And so like, and I got to pray with him right there in that moment and to see the difference in him. But that experience to me just showed me that like people are looking for something real. And it gets back to the verse that says, how then can they hear unless somebody's going to preach to them? And that does, that word preach doesn't mean you get up behind a pulpit and say, hey, let me give you my 3 points in a conclusion. But it's like, essentially, how are people going to hear about Jesus unless you tell them? So even in that moment, a super late at night conversation, this kid could literally see in my eyes the passion that I had talking about Jesus. And it was funny because I didn't even recognize in the moment. I felt like we were just talking. And he said, you know, that everything shifted when that conversation started. And so even with our students now, I just try telling them, you know, if you step out and you're willing to share that faith, you know, the Holy Spirit will come and give you those words. He will give you favor. He will open doors that you may not be able to open. And, you know, so really that's the biggest thing for me was in that experience. I'm like, we can't afford not to tell people. You just can't. You can't afford not to tell people. And I've tried to be a lot more sensitive to telling the cashier at Walmart or at the grocery store or little things like that. You know, we are so quick to, we don't want to be inconvenienced. You know, but I'm like, Jesus inconvenienced himself for us, you know, so what inconvenience is a 5-minute conversation at a grocery store? And so really that was a big turning point for me that, and I'm like, you know what, in anything that I do, any job that I have from here on out, like I'm looking for people that need to hear about Jesus and they're everywhere. But for me, like I said, in that moment, it just kind of that conversation kind of revived that evangelistic part of me that says, hey, people are looking for something real. They're looking for that. And when he could literally see it in my eyes, he was like, I want that. Like, whatever you're doing, like, I want that. And so that really kind of transformed my idea of evangelism. It doesn't have to be in a team on a missions trip or at church. And I even tell our kids all the time, I don't know if my senior pastor would like me saying this, but I'm like, hey, I love it when you guys bring friends to church, but I love it even more when you take Jesus out of the church. If you pray to somebody at your school, on the streets, like I would rather have you talk to somebody out there than you bring somebody into the church. Not that bringing somebody to church is bad, but I'm like, when you are willing to go out and share that, that's how you know it's real. That's the mark of a disciple, is somebody that's taking that message with them, not just coming on a Wednesday or a Sunday to hear for themselves. And so, you know, that for me was just a big turning point of realizing like, man, people want this, but who's going to share it with them? Mm-hmm. You know, and that for me just really kind of woke that part of me up, and it hasn't shut off since.
Man, Chris, this has been an incredible interview. Thank you so much for sharing from your heart. I think one thing that your story definitely proves that a lot of people take for granted, you know, the life of a disciple is one of continual growth, continual change. That growth and change isn't always easy. It's painful. And just because somebody is a minister does not mean they have everything figured out. We are all in the process, and we all have a responsibility to both seek after Christ and to also go and to let his light shine out of us and reach other people, to invite them to come and follow along with us. And so I thank you for your honesty and vulnerability and sharing your story with us today.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it.